joining us here at Goldman Sachs for our full year results presentation, going into the detail behind the headline results we announced a few weeks ago. And a bit of a break from our usual format, as I'm joined not only by our outgoing, but also our incoming CFOs. Today marks John's 22nd and final set of results, and what a set of results to bow out on. I'm also delighted to welcome Penny James, our new CFO, as of Thursday. And Penny will be sharing some of her thoughts with you later. And as ever, other members of my team are here in the audience. So without further ado, let's kick off, as ever, with the highlights. 2017 is the fifth successive year that we've delivered a strong financial performance. Our clear strategy and determination to make insurance much easier and better value for our customers have been the driving force behind these results. And 2017 was a great year for the group. We grew premiums by 3.6%, and within that, our own brands were up 9.3% versus 2016, a great result and largely driven by another excellent year for our Direct Line brand. Our continued focus on improving efficiency combined with growth in direct own brands meant we improved both the underlying expense ratio and the commission ratio. Operating profit from ongoing operations was £611 million. Combined ratio was a very strong 91.8%. ROTE came in at 21.7%. This excellent set of results and strong capital generation means we are today proposing a final dividend of 13.6 pence and a special dividend of 15 pence. Finally, our high-quality balance sheet is reflected in our solvency capital ratio of 162%, even after those dividends. I'm going to come back later in the presentation to tell you more about the initiatives we're going to be taking to deliver our medium-term targets, and in particular, our technology plans to support them. So now, for the final time, let me hand over to John.
Thanks, Paul, and good morning, everyone. Let me give you an overview of the main features of the results, as ever. There's more detail in the prelim. As Paul said, this is an excellent set of results, and the highest annual profit we've reported in our five-year history as a listed company. We grew premiums again in 2017, up 3.6%, with a particularly strong result in motor. Ongoing operating profit of £610.9 million was £207 million higher than prior year, which, of course, was impacted by Ogden. At the profit before tax level, we delivered £539 million versus £353 million in 2016, including a net positive £33 million contribution from runoff and restructuring. Finance costs were £66 million higher due to a one-off charge relating to the successful debt refinancing action we took at the end of 2017. The combined ratio was 91.8%, nearly 6 points better than 2016 reported and in line with 2016 pre-Ogden. And weather-adjusted combined operating ratio was towards the lower end of the targeted range. Moving down to operating profit by segment, motor and commercial, which were impacted by Ogden in 2016, delivered significantly better results. This helped offset lower prior year and claims inflation in home. Rescue and other personal lines profit was pretty flat. Turning to premiums on slide six, the strong momentum across our own brands during 2017 enabled us to deliver overall premium growth of 3.6%. This growth was predominantly driven by motor, shown here in the dark blue, where our volume growth combined with strong pricing meant motor premiums were 8.5% ahead of prior year. Home premiums were down around 4% due to partner business, although the picture here is looking up, and we'll talk about that later. We continue to grow rescue premiums, shown in green. This was mainly due to our direct rescue brand, Green Flag. Finally, commercial, where premiums were pretty flat. This reflects a strong year for Direct Line for Business, which grew premiums by 12% in 2017, helping to offset pressure on NIG, which was down 3%. On the right, you can see the overall premium growth was driven by our direct own brands, with Motor, Green Flag and Direct Line for Business all reporting double-digit growth, and home was also ahead of prior year. Looking at policy count, and in this chart, we've highlighted our direct own brands, which continued the growth momentum. It's been another year of strong growth overall, especially in our disruptive brands, Green Flag and Direct Line for Business, which were up 10% and 8% respectively. Motor grew policy count by 5.6%, which shows our unique propositions have been cutting through. Home grew a little as well, up 2%, which is a good result in a very competitive market. Elsewhere in the group, in the broker channel, NIG policy count was flat due to disciplined pricing. The reduction in motor and home partner volumes continued in 2017, although our recent work with RBS NatWest is showing positive growth signs. Other personal lines policies were broadly flat as growth in rescue linked was offset by rescue partners and travel. Looking at expense and commission ratios, I'm on slide 10, starting with the expense ratio, which is in dark blue. Growing premiums provided us with the leverage to improve the underlying expense ratio in 2017. The reported expense ratio of 25.3% was flat versus prior year, but if you exclude the impairment charge from both years, the underlying ratio was half a point better, and in line with our ambition to reduce the ratio over time. We incurred an impairment charge on IT of 56.9 million, and our total cost base, excluding that, increased by around £28 million in 2017. This was mainly due to higher levies linked to our higher premiums. Flat staff and marketing costs, alongside growing premiums, show we've been getting efficiency improvements. The commission ratio shown in light blue was 9.1% in 2017 and 2.4 points better than the prior year. About half of this improvement reflects changes to business mix and new partnership arrangements, and the other half relates primarily to differences in weather, escape of water, and prior year, as these automatically flow through to partners via the commission line. Overall, we're pleased with the ratio improvement we delivered in 2017 and are confident that we can deliver on our ambition to lower these ratios over time. Moving on to the loss ratio, the headline loss ratio improved by 3.5 points to 57.4%, mainly due to movements in prior year reserve releases. As for the current year loss ratio, which excludes weather, this was stable. At a segmental level, motor delivered a strong improvement in current year ratio, which was offset by higher ratios in home and commercial. Prior year releases remained significant at $392 million, or 12.4% of earned premiums. This was lower than recent years, although higher than 2016, which was impacted by the Ogden rate change. Home weather was benign again in the second half, taking the total for the year to £13 million against a budget of £65 million. And note that the weather load for home for 2018 is £55 million, reflecting lower volumes as Nationwide runs off. And the commercial weather load for 2018 is £20 million. Overall, we've improved our cost and commission ratios while holding our attritional loss ratio steady, so have successfully delivered what we set out to do, namely to improve current year profitability. We expect this trend of improving the contribution from current year to continue over time. Over time, the balance between current year and prior year will shift within our 93-95% medium-term combined operating ratio target. The point where this rebalancing reaches maturity is several years away. Looking quickly at operating profit, here you can see total ongoing operating profit increased by $207 million to $611 million due to significant increases in motor and commercial, which were impacted by Ogden in 2016. Motor recouped $49 million of this Ogden cost in the first half of 2017. The contribution from the non-motor businesses was $247 million. That's 40% of profit in 2017, showing the benefits of our diversified strategy. Commercial performed well and again contributed strongly to the group. Rescue has been a solid performer with strong potential we can realise. Let's look in a bit more detail at each of the segments, starting with motor. Motor pricing was very strong in 2017, albeit stronger in the first half than the second half. Our prices, which exclude IPT, were up 9.5% over the year, ahead of the ABI figures. As we said at the half year, the reduction in risk mix reflects the way we deployed the Ogden price change as we put through higher increases for younger drivers where the exposure is greatest. Strong new business sales and higher retention supported an overall increase in premiums of 8.5%, and we grew policy count by 3.8%. Motor profit was up $215 million to $364 million, and much of this movement is explained by the change to the Ogden rate, which reduced motor profit by around $150 million in 2016. The underwriting rate result also reflects a material improvement in the current year loss ratio as a result of the strong trading. We benefited from two tailwinds in terms of current year performance. First, there was the one-off benefit from having fixed our reinsurance costs ahead of the Ogden rate change. Secondly, we had better claims experience than we expected. These two tailwinds, combined with the strong pricing, enabled us to improve our margins, and this was reflected in a 4.4 points improvement in the current year loss ratio. We think these tailwinds, which will have benefited a number of insurers, may also explain why pricing wasn't so strong in the second half of the year. At this point, we are viewing the better-than-expected claims data in 2017 as one-off. We have not changed our view of long-term claims inflation being 3 to 5% per annum. Finally, at the end of December, we renewed our excess loss reinsurance at a somewhat increased cost, reflecting the change in the Ogden discount rate. We renewed all layers but retained 10% of the first risk layer. We were pleased with the overall outcome, which looks better than some of the industry commentary we've read. Next to home. Now, at the half year, we highlighted a number of actions we've taken to mitigate the scope of water inflation. And we're pleased that our actions have helped return this to more normal levels. We believe we were one of the first to respond to escape of water. We increased our own brand prices in 2017, particularly on new business in the first half. This contributed to an overall pricing increase of 2.6% across own brands. The shift towards price comparison websites continued in 2017, and as we've written more volume through this typically lower premium channel, this led to an overall reduction in own brand average premiums of 1.4%. When you take into account our pricing actions, IPT increases, and last year's premium disclosure, we're very pleased that in a market with more customers shopping around, we're able to grow own brand policy count and premiums. Moving to operating profit, home profit was down $38 million to $129 million due to lower prior year from the December 2015 storms, so we're up against a tough comparator. The escape of water inflation also had an impact in the year. However, the operating profit overall was still above our normalized level as a result of another benign weather year, with only $13 million of weather losses versus our budgeted level of $65 million. Now to the other two businesses. Commercial delivered a very strong result, £74 million of operating profit, which is the highest since the group was listed. Excluding the impact of Ogden in 2016, profit was up 11%, and commercial combined operating ratio was 93.4%, which was similar to 2016 before the Ogden change. Commercial current year loss ratio was up a bit in 2017. We interpreted the claims data cautiously at the year end, and the reserving therefore looks conservative. And weather was also benign in 2017. Finally, rescue and other personal lines profit was broadly flat, with a combined profit of £44 million. Within that, rescue achieved a slightly better result, offset by a reduction in other personal lines. Moving on to investment, overall investment return rose a little to $175.4 million in 2017, and that's due to very strong gains both on property and on credit. You can see that the low UK interest rate environment continued to impact the group's net investment income, down $10 million to $140.1 million after hedging. As a reminder, our investment objective is to match the duration of our UK liabilities and protect the group's capital. We diversify credit exposures away from the UK and then hedge to bring the currency and interest rate elements back to sterling floating rate. So while higher US interest rates on our US portfolio help top line investment income, currently low UK rates are reflective of a higher hedging number and therefore lower net investment income. The result of all this is a net income yield on a sterling floating rate basis of 2.1% in 2017. And for 2018, we expect the trend to continue with a net investment yield after hedging back to sterling floating rate to be again around 2.1%. For gains, the performance of our property portfolio has been very strong since the commencement of that portfolio in 2012. Given the current levels of the UK property market, we don't expect significant gains on property in 2018. Overall, therefore, we anticipate a total investment return in the region of £150 million in 2018. Now, looking at how we get from headline ongoing operating profit to profit after tax on slide 17, the runoff segment continued to benefit from positive prior year releases, and this was partially offset by £12 million of restructuring other one-off costs. So combined, these two items contributed £32 million to the overall result. Moving down to finance costs, these included a one-off charge of £66.1 million, which relates to the buyback of Tier 2 debt following the restricted Tier 1 issue. And that brings us down to a profit after tax of £434 million, £155 million higher than the prior year. Now, looking ahead, we're changing our guidance on the reporting of runoff and restructuring. We previously guided to runoff and restructuring broadly offsetting one another over the four-year period 2015 to 2018. As at the end of 2017, the net result of these two lines was actually a profit of £43 million. We've decided to stop reporting these separately and to report a single operating profit line. We will, of course, highlight any material future one-offs, and the simplification has no impact on our targets. With regard to finance costs, these will reduce to approximately half the previous annual charge of around £40 million. With the restricted Tier 1 coupon of approximately £15 million being reported as a movement in equity. Now, in a moment, I'll hand over to Penny, who's going to take you through our capital position and also talk about the outlook for DLG. I believe our prospects are excellent and that DLG is well-placed to continue to produce great returns for shareholders. Here's a summary of how things have turned out in the 5 years since we went public. The first couple of years, our priority was to put the fundamentals right, pricing, claims, and cost efficiency. Over that period, we held our direct own brands policy count flat. But we came out of that period in 2015. That's the year we sold international, and have been growing direct own brand customer numbers steadily since then. These have grown around 5% in each of the last 2 years. Throughout our time as a listed company, we've stayed focused on a combined operating ratio, target, sharpening that target, frequently, and more recently extended it to the medium term. And we've managed capital effectively in order to translate that combined operating ratio and profit into strong return on tangible equity. All this has delivered great shareholder returns as illustrated by the chart at the bottom right-hand corner. I'm confident DLG is well positioned to bring you great returns in the future as it's done in the past. Thank you for your support for and debates with me over the last 5 years and in the next hour. And now I'm delighted to pass the baton on to Penny.
Thanks, John. Firstly, I'd like to thank John for his extraordinary patience, putting up with all my questions and curiosity over the past few months. Many of you already know me, so I shan't go through my background here, but if we haven't already met, please catch me afterwards and make the acquaintance. Now, I've had the luxury of a lengthy handover period. Since November, I've spent most of my time visiting different parts of the business. I've been everywhere from the customer-facing areas to digital, from NIG to marketing, from partnerships to accident repair centres. And in this time, I've observed many things about DLG that I think give it a distinct advantage. But there are two that I want to highlight to you. First, and most important, is customer centricity. Whether in a call centre talking to customers, or talking with a car mechanic, or discussing strategy with the exco, one thing is clear and consistent in this organisation, and that's the focus on the customer. You can feel it in the direct line propositions, which are quite distinct. You can feel it in the unscripted customer calls. And you can feel it in the sensitivity with which our call handlers deal with our customers. Customer centricity is consciously part of the culture here at DLG. And I believe it's what's delivered the direct own brand's growth that John's been talking about. Second is the depth of talent. Some of my new colleagues have been here for some years and have been the driving force behind the success you've seen on the slide before this. But others are much newer to the organisation and, like myself, hopefully bring fresh thinking and are leading areas such as data, procurement, technology, green flag, and so on. But there's also plenty of opportunity for us to improve. I believe we can further leverage these strengths and build our capabilities across all our channels. So I'm enthusiastic about the direction we're going. And there's always further to go on costs and efficiency. Paul will talk in detail later about our view of where we stand and what we're doing. But in summary, I believe there are some great differentiating strengths, an energized team, and lots to do. So I'm really excited about what lies ahead. Now, turning back to the numbers, let's take a look at the balance sheet that I've inherited. Here, we have our first full year of operating under the Solvency II partial internal model, and I'm very pleased to be presenting strong capital generation. It's important to note that the figures are still draft and won't be finalised until the regulatory returns go in May. But take looking at the side, moving from left to right, we start the year with a surplus above requirement of $910 million. Despite the growth in the business during the year, our capital requirements actually reduced very slightly by around $14 million. There are lots of moving parts, but it's worth noting that whilst we're still growing, we're also seeing a reduction in our net reserves. This reflects claims settling on older years, the new years mainly being reinsured down to around the £1 million level, and recognition of the cautious approach to reserving the group has taken, evidenced by a history of prior year positive development. Capital generation from our operating activities was £487 million. Whilst there are some differences in between the bases and Solvency II and IFRS that create variations year on year, generation post-CAPEX should broadly reflect the IFRS profit over time, though currently we're in a period of higher capital investment. Capital expenditure was £94 million and in line with our previous guidance of £80 million to £100 million per year on average between 2017 and 2019. And that reflects the investment across the business, which Paul will be discussing later. Our successful debt refinancing at the end of 2017 slightly strengthened the overall position. And finally, we've announced dividends totalling £486 million for the year, which I'll now turn to. The strong financial performance and capital position has enabled the group to rebase the regular dividend and recommend a special. The board's recommended a final regular dividend of 13.6 pence, an increase of 40 pence on last year, and consistent with the guidance given at half year. In addition, the board's declared a special dividend of 15p. Turning to solvency, at the half year, the group announced in normal circumstances, the board expects to operate at a ratio of around the middle of the risk appetite range of 140 to 180%. After the final and special dividends are taken into account, the group's estimated solvency ratio was actually 162%. This guidance as to the level of solvency in normal conditions remains unchanged, but I would remind people that the nature of capital modelling includes some inherent volatility, and therefore people should anticipate a small variation year on year, even in normal circumstances. Before I hand over to Paul, I'd like to close on outlook and targets. I inherit a strong and well-managed balance sheet, a history of prudent reserving, and the current underwriting heavily de-risked through reinsurance. As you've heard, this is a business which has shown real momentum, disciplined underwriting, and an ongoing focus on efficiency. This, together with the investment across a range of initiatives, gives me confidence to reiterate the medium-term targets. From a cost perspective, it's important the group maintains its focus on progressive improvements in efficiency. So we plan to continue to reduce our expense ratio and our commission ratio. Assuming current claims trends continue, we aim to deliver a 93% to 95% combined ratio through the medium term. And as our investments in business yield benefits, we expect to see a further rebalancing of our profitability between prior year towards current year. This is a key focus area for me. Having rebased the regular dividend by 40% in 2017, we now seek to grow the dividend in line with the business. And finally, on capital, we expect to be around the middle of the 140 to 180% risk appetite range in normal circumstances. Of course, we maintain an ambition in the long term to achieve at least a 15% return on tangible equity. It's good to see that in striving to achieve these objectives, the team remain absolutely committed to invest in the future of this business so that it's well placed strategically and operationally for the changing environment ahead. And with that, I'll hand over to Paul to give you a real flavour of what we're actually doing.
Thank you, Penny and John. Penny, it's great to have you here. John, we'll come back to you later. So as we've been through in 2017, we've delivered some great numbers. and these numbers haven't been achieved by accident. They're a result of concerted management action on our priorities, which, as we set out 6 months ago, are to maintain revenue growth, to reduce our expense and commission ratios, and to deliver underwriting and pricing excellence to fuel growth at good loss ratios. As you can see, we've delivered across all three. Our own brands have driven our revenues higher. We've delivered good improvements to both our commission and underlying expense ratios. And we've delivered that growth at good attritional loss ratios, all of which combine to grow our current year profits by £87 million, albeit, as John said, including some one-offs. To keep this momentum, we continue to deliver initiatives to improve the business. And to explain the next wave of initiatives we're investing in, let's look at our channel strategies. So here's a chart which we showed last year when I talked about returning our direct business to growth, having spent the previous phase optimizing our business for PCWs. And this time, we've also included partnerships. We believe that our strength in all three channels is a major advantage for us at DLG. We start from a strong position, with leading brands in the specific channels supported by group-wide excellence, a customer service, great digital front ends, and claims excellence. Today, I'm going to set out our plans to push forward on all three channels at once. On direct, our most advantaged channel, we want to keep up the momentum, particularly pushing hard into SME and rescue. We also think we can do that in a way that's increasingly efficient for our customers and ourselves. On PCWs, which is where about three-quarters of motor policies and about two-thirds of home policies are bought, our ambition is to have the best capabilities, and when we have them, to grow in this channel. And partnerships, which took a bit of a back seat to our own brand business during the early part of the plan, but behind the scenes, we've been investing in our digital capability such that today, not only is our major home partnership returning to growth, but we're now in a position where selectively we will start to target and to win new partnerships. Sitting behind these initiatives for all three channels is a unified group-wide data and technology plan, which I'll update you on in a moment. Let's start by going deeper into all of these channels, starting with direct. And as you know, we're really excited about our direct business. We've re-established growth and still see lots of opportunity, and not just in our core motor and home business. We're going to be instrumental in driving the micro SME market to go direct, and we want to shake up the direct rescue market and get a much bigger share of the value. So our objectives here are pretty simple. First is for us to continue to fuel our brand and customer advantages to maintain that growth. The second is there are many ways we can improve our efficiency of how we deal with customers. So let's talk through some of the initiatives we've got here. First, we're just launching two brand new unique direct line propositions on home and motor, and our pre-testing says they may be our best yet. And you may already have seen our new fast response launch on home on the TV over the weekend. Direct line customers are going to get these new propositions on top of the many unique propositions we've already given them. And as you know, we have a fantastic new SME system, which we've rolled out already to bed and breakfast owners and to hair and beauty traders, and we're going to push forward significantly on that rollout to get to 75% of our target market by the end of this year. Green Flag, as you know, we've put back into a single business unit under new management, and they're developing an exciting new plan which we'll share with you soon. Turning to efficiency, we're going to enable customers to do more for themselves by self-service. And we see an opportunity in automated processes and increasingly straight-through processing. These things we believe customers will actually prefer, or they won't notice, but they're going to significantly improve our efficiency in running the business. Let's now move on to PCWs, where, as you know, we have the best brand in Churchill and a great price-fighting brand in Privilege. We've done a lot of work to be good on PCWs. We're competent in pricing and fraud, which matter a lot in this area, and that's enabled us to be competitive and to have a steady share at adequate margins. But our ambitions are much greater. We're investing to have class-leading capabilities, and when we have these, we will want to grow this channel. So So what do we need to do to achieve that? Well, first of all, as part of our overall IT systems, we're investing in the latest generation pricing engine, and with it, a series of application fraud initiatives. We're also, in parallel, developing an alternative pricing model using new maths and machine learning to come up with a model which is equally predictive, but importantly, non-correlated with our existing pricing models. We're also steadily pushing out our quote footprint and have high ambitions to keep Churchill in great space at the top of the preference for PCW brands. Finally, partnerships, which we're going to split into three. First, our home partnerships. We have some stability here, having secured the RBS and NatWest partnership, and our objective is to grow that partnership and selectively to acquire new ones. The work we've been doing behind the scenes to knit our systems together with theirs to enhance the journey for both customers and branch staff is working very well. We've significantly increased new business sales and thereby stabilised the book. So here we want to use this platform to add new partners. For rescue and travel, our ambition is a bit different. These are businesses finely priced, which we like to get because they can add useful scale, but the economics also need to work for us. We've had a bit more of a mixed picture here. We've recently extended our travel partnership with Nationwide and won the RBS Rescue Partnership. Our objective here is to create a platform for growth, and our next initiative is the development of a brand new travel system. Now for motor, where the role of partnerships is strategic, and our objective is to be the partner of choice for car manufacturers. Why? Well, the current transformation of the motor industry provides both risks and opportunities to insurers. We want to partner with motor manufacturers to be in that value chain, working with them to create exciting new propositions for customers. That's why we have introduced a relationship with Tesla and our partnership with Peugeot Citroën. And today, I'm absolutely delighted to announce that we've signed a letter of intent with Volkswagen to be their insurance partner in the UK for their brands Audi, Seat, Skoda, Volkswagen, and Volkswagen Commercial for at least 5 years. I hope you'll agree, overall, a really exciting and ambitious set of initiatives across our three main channels. But clearly, to deliver these requires us to have the technology to support it. So let's take a look at where we are in technology, where we've been making real progress. Our systems are resilient and stable, and we have excellent digital and mobile front ends helping us to win in the marketplace today. Our mobile sales for Direct Line have doubled in the past year, supported by class-leading load times. And we continue to improve our web purchase journey with NPS scores up 3.3 percentage points in the last year alone. We've also done a lot on claims, where we're very mature in our running of Guidewire's claims centre, and we also have technology to allow customers to use mobile in the claims process and to be able to fight claims fraud. And this has helped us to significantly increase our claims NPS score, up a further 2 points in the year, and detect significantly more fraud than the market average. But we have more to do. We need to complete rolling out our self-service functionality, and our legacy systems are both expensive to run and lack agility and flexibility. So here our objectives are pretty clear. We want to support the channel strategies that I've just outlined. First, by seeking the leading position on pricing and fraud capabilities. Second, by giving us agility and flexibility on products and propositions. Third, by progressing our story on self-service, automation, and state-through processing. And finally, by enabling us to add partners with agility and speed and giving them the functionality that they want. At the same time, we have another big objective. We also see IT as a major lever in delivering our expense ratio reduction. So our initiatives here are quite clear. We want to complete the build of the latest generation systems to give us that functionality, which I'll cover in a moment. And then we want to run these systems in a much more efficient way. We've already significantly increased our procurement capability, achieving better deals with fewer partners. We have a preference to rent rather than buy infrastructure. And we're increasingly our cloud usage, and we have a plan to reduce and ultimately decommission our expensive mainframe. But let me next go on to focus on the completion of those latest generation systems, which unlock both the functionality and the cost savings. A reminder of our approach here. We have a preference to buy rather than to build, and to select products proven in their respective markets, avoiding a one-size-fits-all model. This approach also enables us to keep our systems up to date as we benefit from ongoing releases and upgrades from our partner suppliers. Finally, we will test rigorously and take a phased rollout approach to manage risk. On our core personal lines business, the functionality, as I said, is good at the front end and good on the claim side with Guidewire's Claim Center. What we're working on now is completing the full implementation of the Guidewire Insurance Suite whilst implementing the Towers Watson Radar Live pricing and underwriting engine, along with supporting systems and infrastructure, which we will connect to a comprehensive set of external data. This will help us deliver against all four of the objectives I set out on the previous chart. Here, as you know, we've had to rework the data architecture, but the new data architecture is agreed, we've taken the impairment, and we're partnering with a systems integrator to complete this deployment. We're building and testing our initial major release this year to start rolling out next year. Elsewhere, we've talked about our SME system, which is going to be rolling out to 75% of target trades this year. And in other personal lines, we're building a new travel system, which will also roll out this year. So a lot of progress in our underlying systems. We've done what we need to do to get us back on track, and we're very excited by the opportunities they'll bring. The systems we're implementing will enable us to move forward on all the initiatives in our channels, and they underpin our medium-term targets. So in summary, 2017 was a great year. We successfully delivered against our priorities, helping us to deliver strong and highly cash-generative earnings. The strong cash generation has helped us both invest in the long term of the business and at the same time deliver to shareholders today with total dividends of 35.4p in 2017. With that, let me go to questions. Right, shall we go forward this way? Start with Ravi.
Thank you. It's Ravi Tanna, Goldman Sachs. I have three questions, please. The first one was just on your investment income guidance. I know you've got a medium-term profit growth target, but obviously with today's guidance on the kind of stable underwriting and fading investment income, at least in 2018, I was just wondering if you could talk to us how you're likely to handle that and whether there's scope for re-risking on the investment portfolio at all. The second one is on the SCR. Could you give us a sense as to whether this is likely to be an ongoing tailwind that will help solvency development, and if so, by how much each year? And then the third one was just on your comment around quote footprint. Just curious to know exactly what the parameters are there and to what extent you're looking to increase your volumes and in what pockets of the market. Thank you.
We go to the first one. So we've said, when you said profit guidance, we of course haven't given, we don't give profit growth guidance. We give dividend growth guidance on our regular dividends, which we've said is 2-3%. And we've sort of aligned that to the growth of the business rather than any individual line. Obviously, we want our profit to grow. Every company does. Clearly, we've got some elements of that are fairly transparent. So we've said medium-term core target within the range 90-95. So far, we've been delivering that, and obviously, we expect that to continue. And we've talked about growth in the business and all the things we're doing to get that growth. So you've got some of the parts of the P&L going in the right direction there, along with installments and other, which tends to go to track what's happening with volumes generally. And then on the investment side, yes, the investment income we're saying is going to be down year on year, 17-18. Once it's got to that point, I think there's the scope for it to grow a little bit with volume. Obviously, it depends then on how much we distribute as dividends as to whether AUM actually grow or not. They haven't always grown. And then I think we'd be looking more to interest rates. I mean, in a way, it's more a penny question because you've got to manage them in the future than a me question. But I think based on where I've been talking with my colleagues and on the investment side, the upside on investment is probably more on UK interest rates than any other individual driver. We're taking roughly the amount of risk we want to take. There probably is some scope to take a bit more investment risk. We've not yet found a new investment class that excites us in that sense. So there could be some tactical moves. I don't expect anything major, but I think you want to keep your powder dry. UK interest rates, we could actually take a bit more risk on UK interest rates because we're quite short and got a lot of cash. I don't think we'd see now as the moment to do it. That's a potential for improvement in interest rates and for us to take a bit more of that risk as the yield curve, assuming it ever does improve in the UK. That's an upside. Do you want to end?
No, I think that's very full. I've been looking to UK interest rates as the main stress. Should I take SCR?
Yeah.
SCR, early days to give a definitive number, but directionally, if you look at the way the reinsurance program changed in 2014, then I think you should expect that those reserves will continue to tick down over time. And there are lots and lots of moving parts in an SCR calculation as it's volatile to a number of things. But those other things being equal, you'd expect to see, I think, some tick down over time again in that SCR, which gives us some options around how we deploy that to support growth and so on and so forth.
Our quote footprint, there's kind of probably three buckets here. So first of all, our quotes for things which we just don't do today, like look at Kate Thatch. We don't do homes with pre-existing subsidence. So here you need some genuinely new expertise to learn because we haven't written those before. We don't have much claims experience. So that's kind of, there are some initiatives to start tackling some of those. Then there's kind of within existing parameters, things which we don't quote for because we don't like the historic performance. And again, we need to kind of continue to grow our expertise there. And so those are both pushing out of the quote footprint. There's not going to be a sudden single bang which takes us to 100% quotability. I think the most important one, though, that we've said here under alternative pricing is not the quotes we return today at all. It's increasing our competitive quote footprint. So today, as you know, we have a single pricing model, which means that either all our brands are pretty competitive or none of our brands are competitive. So we've got a bunch of very, very clever people using new maths machine learning to go off and use all our fantastic claims data but to model it in new ways. And so far, the experience is pretty encouraging that they can model at least as good a loss ratio, but importantly, non-correlating with our business. So we increase the number of customers we can choose, and we're working out how to deploy it. Now, obviously, we need to actually write some business to get some claims, check that claims experience comes through in reality. But that's probably the most significant in terms of the volume from quote footprint versus the pushing out on the overall envelope. It's the competitive quote footprint that's important. All right?
Yeah.
Good. Right, thank you. Yeah, we'll go.
So thank you, Arjun Manvin, UBS. Thanks for the additional disclosure on the systems changes. Just curious, so you said when you're going to roll them out, could you talk maybe a bit about the legacy systems and how quickly they kind of get turned off after the rollout? And a question for Penny, you're on the board of another peer that has much lower cost ratio. So could you maybe indicate some areas where you think Direct Line is a little bit on the fat on the expense side?
Very good. I mean, systems, it's going to be multiple years to fully be able to switch off all legacy systems and mainframes. But that's not to say that as we reduce our usage of mainframes, we won't be able to save some money. So it's not, you know, clearly there is a drop when you get rid of the mainframe, but we'll be reducing our costs in the meantime. And that's just one of the parts of us running our systems more effectively. As I said, we've got fantastic new procurement capability. We're really leveraging our scale. We've probably inherited a little bit of a bank-like approach to cost management on IT, and we now have a very different approach, which is really leveraging our scale, consolidating in fewer partners, as I say, renting versus buying infrastructure. So, you know, we've got – it's not – at the end that the cost savings come through on IT, it's actually quite progressive. Steve's got a great plan on that. Penny, fat?
Fat. Look, I think I don't want to comment on Amber in particular, but what I should acknowledge is there's a different model here. So there are some costs that occurred in this business that are done so for good reason. So it's a direct player, the marketing costs look different, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't think we should necessarily compare the two head on. We need to be mindful of what that cost is generating. There are some areas where the costs are higher than you would choose. I think property costs, we have some legacy issues there, though they're probably not going away in a hurry. IT is clearly an overhead. I think we've got the right actions in place to address those and bring those down, but it will take time to actually get the decommissioning, as Paul suggested. And then there are some broader areas where I think you can generally just continue to tighten. So I think Paul mentioned procurement, which is a great example where it feels as though we've moved from not being top of the list to having quite a sophisticated approach to it in the last year. So I think that will have some outworking. So I don't think you should look at every cost line. There are some business model differences, but there is still a little way to go, I think.
Yeah, good. I think it's fantastic to have Penny around the ExCo table. She does bring a challenge on that area, and it's not one we're new to, but it's, you know, as we said, having fresh blood and fresh energy on that, I think, is really important. And, you know, as you know, we've got the target to continue to reduce our expense ratio, which we're all behind. Good. Go next, James and Alan.
Thank you. James Sharp from Citi. I had three questions, please. Firstly, on the LTIPs. So the LTIPs, they kind of fully vest at around 17.5 to 20.5 return on tangible. You're currently making 21.7. There was a little bit of a headwind, or a tailwind, I should say, with lower weather. That might take off a little bit going forward. But I just struggle to see where the incentive is to actually drive the ROE higher and why that's the appropriate level for the LTIPs. That's the first question. Secondly, just a numbers question, really, on the reserving. So if I look at the mix between the IBNR and the case reserves, there's a sharp drop in the IBNR in 2017. Just like to know what's explaining that. Seems it's partly Ogden, but I would have expected case reserves to have fallen as well. And then thirdly, around the GDPR, I'm just interested around this right to be forgotten and what that might mean for things like no claims bonuses and the like, particularly in motor. Thank you.
Good. So LTIPs, you'll have noticed our REMCO has stretched our ROTE targets by 250 basis points. So were you advocating they went further? Or?
Part of the reason why that happened is because the gearing level's gone up a little bit.
Yeah, so about half of that increase is the debt, which is worth about 130 basis points, and the rest is just further stretch. And listen, the REMCO has a job to do, as you rightly point out, to stretch the targets. To keep the carrot sufficiently at the right distance from the horse to make it motivating. And I think your observation explains why they've put 250 basis points on the target.
Maybe you can help me understand just a bit sort of why that is a stretch, because if I look at the ROTE in recent years, you're consistently making that kind of number. So it's sort of you don't have to do anything and then you get paid out fully on the LTIPs.
Yeah, I think delivering 20.5% ROTE, I think, is a very good performance. And I think I think to increase the targets in one go by 250 basis points, I think is quite a change. And I think they've done their job to make the target more stretching. I think if I'd have come in here and said, okay, they're putting some number in the mid-20s up, I think that would have been send all sorts of inappropriate signals about the business and prospects and all sorts of other things. But I think they were mindful of the need to make sure the targets were more consistent with consensus at the top end. And I think a 250 basis point increase, I think, is quite a move. You can always argue, I'm sure you can give feedback that you want more, but management thinks it's quite a big increase.
Reserving. First of all, we haven't changed anything in how we reserve or in the strength we have. You're right, Ogden is the main reason why that has changed, as what was in IBNR has moved into outstanding claims reserves once we did the case review, which was earlier in the first half of 17. The other thing is you might expect the ratio of IBNR to outstanding claims to reduce as the old years, which had the very high or deductible on reinsurance runoff. So we're not surprised that there's some reduction in that ratio. But there's no underlying change in policy or reserving that should worry you.
Good. Mike, do you want to do GDPR?
Yeah, absolutely.
Just wait for Mike. We'll call us.
I think the first thing to do
one.
Is...
Mike.
Okay, thanks. It is complicated, and we will abide by the legislation. There's always been a right to be forgotten. I think it's when you look at NCD, there's a legitimate use for NCD as well. So we'll be using that as part of it. And at the end of the day, you know, for GDPR is all about collecting consents for the right things, and that's what we'll be focused on really. So we don't think it's this is a major issue really, if that's what you were hinting at. Does that make sense?
No, stuff like convictions, I think we've got a more sensible outcome than some people initially were concerned about. Do you want to mention convictions?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the right to use convictions when you're rating is one of our biggest concerns in the insurance market. And again, that seems to have been accepted that we can use that, and that would have been a concern because it directly relates to risk. But also, as an insurance industry, we've got to, you know, take off that conviction at the right moment. So that's what we'll be making sure that we do as well.
My concern would be that people are more inclined to claim for things like scratches and things like that, because then they can just have a right to be forgotten, and then they can go across the new provider.
No. That's not what we share NTDs on a queue database and trying to make it easier to share it around the industry. And so we'll be collecting consent to do that.
Thank you.
Good. Right, Alan.
Thanks, Alan Devlin from Barclays. A couple of questions. First of all, I wanted to give us some more color on your comments on claims inflation. You had a favorable year this year, but you're not, you're giving the guidance for 3 to 5% going forward. I wanted to give us some more color what's going on. And then just second on the reinsurance, you've taken 10% of the first £1 million layer. Now that's much more of a working layer. Did you consider taking more of that, retaining more of that risk, or would you consider that in the future? Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, we've always said that having a balance sheet gives us the optionality to be selective on the lower layers and to get a good price, and we think we did use that, so 90% is pretty perfect for us in terms of the level of placement of that. We negotiated well, and we think we got a good deal. Time will tell. You'll see our actual costs at the half year, but we think it's a bit commercially sensitive to share that now. I think on motor claims, we are treating it as a... that business as usual will resume in terms of 3 to 5% inflation. There's some reasons to think that it will, we think that it might not. So yeah, more benign reasons are the Jackson and the Medco initiatives may have had some impact, a positive impact on small bodily injury. Those were a few years ago, so we may be seeing some positives from that. Driver miles, inflation's kind of pretty modest as a result of, we think, the fuel price increases as a result of sterling's weakness. Car tech may be helping. We're incentivizing people to have cars that automatically brake. And then also weather is another reason. It might be a one-off because we had some good weather this year. So there's a mixture of stuff you could say. Are they cyclical? Are they structural? Obviously, going in the other direction, cars are just getting much more expensive to repair, and that trend continues. So I think for those of us that went around the accident repair centres, you see a total loss of a car that doesn't look that damaged because of all the sensors and airbags and stuff that goes into it. So we think it's a safe working assumption for it to be 3 to 5, and we will continue to track it. Obviously, we had better experience of that in 2017, which is why we booked 4.5% better attritional loss ratio in the year. And, of course, we had the benefit of the reinsurance protection as well. Yeah, we'll do each side so we know where we're doing. Dom?
Good morning, Dom Imani from Exane BNP Paribas. Just one follow up on the LTIP question. The return on tangible equity target obviously went up, but not in your targets for the market. Were you tempted to increase them in line?
Yep.
Just two other questions. One is just in terms of the competitive environment. You're growing ahead of market. A number of your competitors are talking about very ambitious growth plans. Are you seeing any signs, in particular in motor, of competition coming in and in terms of pricing and margins? And then thirdly, on rescue, one of your big competitors has been flagging challenges, I guess, in that market. What are your reflections on that? Is this actually a positive view, or is it actually something that makes you think again about your plans there? Thank you.
So ROTI targets, let me explain what our 15 is. What it isn't is a cap on our ROTI. We're incentivized, maybe not to James's full taste, but we're incentivized now to keep pushing that up another 250 basis points. It doesn't stop us delivering the returns. What it is it's a thing which we use in making business decisions every day about initiatives and growth. And I think we should be saying yes to initiatives that deliver 15 ROTE that would help us grow. Putting in a 20 target would make us a smaller business, albeit a bit less profitable. So I think in that role, I think you can understand the 15 target. And of course, it does get a bit easier with the post the debt restructuring. In terms of competitive markets, I mean, I think we're still calling the motor market rational to the extent of, and follow up with Mike on the detail, but I mean, basically we're saying that the market gave up some of the gains, and you can kind of see it pretty much when the government announced the intention to revise Ogden in September. You know, that changed people's views of what that cost would be. And then everyone's probably had very good claims experience. So I don't think the market's irrational, albeit the prices are coming down. And I think, you know, as we've always said, prices should come down in a competitive market when claims costs come down. And I think that's, you know, that's good for all stakeholders. I think the home market's actually quite competitive. We're, again, not calling it irrational. There's more supply than demand in home. It's an attractive looking market. So whilst we are positively seeing some pricing inflation, we don't think that's quite sufficient to cover claims inflation. So that's, you know, that market we're saying is rational but very competitive, and that, you know, should season, I think, the view of how we see that particular market developing going forward. We're not necessarily going to see return to sort of previous years. You can probably start to see the 17 performance as kind of a new level that we'll work from. Rescue. Well, I was going to say, I think we quite like the rescue market, and we're probably on the insurgent side, as we've said. We're doing pretty competitive advertising, which I'm sure if you haven't seen, you should, which is naming competitors. And I think we quite like them. We quite like the way that market's developing for us.
More to come. Though.
Yes. Did you final two? Greg, how are you?
Thought I'd wait to the end this time. So it's Greg, KBW. Just three quick questions. One is escape of water. You've been a bit cryptic on the timing of when these remedial actions will start to kick in on an earned rate. I wonder if you can talk about that. The second point is you mentioned the commercial attritional loss ratio ticked up, and you spoke about claims data, and then you want to be conservative. Are we seeing some negative trends there? I mean, that surprised me. You want to talk about those trends you're seeing there? And then also I see that the commercial liability lines prior year development was quite high. I was wondering to what extent that is sustainable or not, or if it's a one-off.
Good. Might you want to escape the water?
Indeed. Quite a quick answer.
I mean, clearly we talked about escape water at the half year, and we kind of indicated that we think that inflation is, you know, we've got a grip of the claims inflation there. Just a reminder, it wasn't just about putting prices up to cover escape of water. It was very much underwriting and across the claim supply chain where we've implemented actions. Our sense is they have, you know, stabilised now. Whilst we won't recover all that inflation of the past, we think there is stability in there now, and we call out, you know, it feeds into our view that long-term claim inflation is still at 3-5%, and we've got a good grip of that situation.
Is it 3-5 in home as well?
Both.
In home as well, yeah, absolutely.
Just to make it easy for you, Greg.
On commercial, on the reserving at the year end, no, I don't think there are trends, and my commercial colleagues agree, we haven't seen any adverse trends in the claims data, but there are some blips, and you know, we've decided to treat those conservatively. We'll tell you if they develop as trends, but we don't see that yet. Certainly not, you know, not calling that. Commercial general liability has been a very strong performer for, you know, many years, and it's reserved very conservatively because it's quite long tail, and we've always had John, he's nodding, very good runoff from that portfolio, and I think we'll expect that to continue.
Good. Yes, and then we'll go to the other side of the room.
Great. It's David Bracewell here from Redburn. Two questions. One on the kind of change in the mix in terms of moving to your own brand policies. My expectation is that has a higher margin than maybe the partnerships business, and therefore I would have expected or hoped to see some kind of improvement to the guidance on the combined ratio there as you kind of continue that shift to own brand. So perhaps, can you tell me why you haven't changed the guidance there? And then the second question, a quick one, I think, on motor pricing. Given the reinsurance renewals you've had and the change in price, should we expect you to be able to increase prices in 2018 to offset that, or did you kind of get that in 2017 in terms of price rises?
Yeah. So we were pricing with a view of what the reinsurance would be, and as I said, we're slightly the right side of that in terms of what we've seen. So we've already done that. Own brand mix, John?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, we're seeing that we're going to see that move, and we're seeing it already. Partly because clearly own brands are outgrowing partners. Even when we get partners back into an NIG into growth, own brands was likely to outgrow them. Own brands have, obviously, they don't have the same commission cost. They do have a distribution cost that's different. They can have a slightly worse loss ratio, particularly on home. Partners have a very good loss ratio. There's a few moving parts. Bottom line is it's all kind of built into our plan. So our plan, which, of course, shows the 93 to 95 with the expense ratio and commission ratio coming down, is all built on this very trend you're looking to see. So I can't say it's going to make it better than we've said, but it will underpin what we have said, if that makes sense.
Great. We'll move to the side of the room.
Andreas van Emden, Peel Hunt. Two questions, please. First of all, on moving to Radar Live and your pricing model in motor, what were you missing up to now in your pricing agility, and where will this take you? Does this take you to intraday pricing, for example, across all your channels? And where do you think it's, in which channel do you think it's going to be most useful? And secondly, on rescue, as you grow that business, could you comment on whether you see any synergies between your insurance business, particularly the motor book, and rescue as you scale up? Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, listen, we talk here about Green Flag own brand, but we also have a very important business in Linked, and Linked is a big part of our plans as well, and all our initiatives will support that channel and package accounts, which is the third channel. So yes, in terms of cross selling, that's, you know, that's kind of a feature of our plans. If you're asking about whether we should have a Green Flag insurance, motor insurance brand, I think we've got plenty of insurance brands for now, in terms of motor insurance.
Well, how much of motor policies, direct line motor policies or others, do you sell through your partnerships in rescue or Green Flag? In percentage of policies, are you selling?
Well, we don't
bundle,
the partnerships are separate.
Rescue.
So the rescue partnerships are separate from the insurance partnerships.
Generally, if you split the book up, there's a lot of volume of policies that we do, as we've said, for very low margin, but to give us rescue scale, which is really important because you have more vans nearer, more motorways, and then in more cities from that. So, and then we've got kind of the two businesses which are better on margin, which are the standalone and then the Linked. And I think we've talked mainly about the standalone business here. What we're saying is there's a very good Linked business as well, which we are, you know, we have good levels of selling rescue into our car insurance customers. We're probably quite mature at that, and I think more of the opportunity we see is as the standalone business against other standalone players.
And that's the one with the highest margin. That's the bit of rescue that has the highest margin.
Pricing, we get lots of stuff from Radar Live. So we get lots more external data. We get a more accuracy of modeling. We get faster deployment. Intraday is a functionality which we, some stage, could choose to deploy. We need to work out the merits and demerits of it. Intraday, you're not learning much about claims. You're learning something about how other people are pricing the market. So it gives us the full kit. What we switch on, we, you know, leave it to us. But we see a lot of value in the first things I mentioned, which we're going to benefit from. And application fraud is another big, you know, a big leverage. The other thing is, much more efficient to run. So at the moment, we model separately from deploying, which is not only creates some inaccuracy and takes some lag, but also is like lots of work. So we're going to remove work from it. So it's really good. Really excited about that. Right, yes. The sides of the room suddenly got excited. Right.
Roger Zwi from Deutsche Bank. I have three questions. First one on home loss ratio. Can you talk a little bit about the dynamics of attritional loss ratio and from the change in business mix? I seem to understand that there's some offset in reducing commission ratios and higher attritional loss ratios, so just the dynamics of the two. And then the second one would be on systems. So I think you talked that it will take some time for you to switch off mainframe. So is it fair to assume that expense ratio or expense benefit would be a bit back-end loaded from this technology? And finally, just a numbers question. So you're changing runoff, you're putting it in operating. The guidance of runoff offsetting restructuring costs, is that still valid for the next few years? Thank you.
Charles, do you want to do one and three, and I'll do the second.
Yeah. And so on the last one, we're including it. If there's nothing to report, by implication, there shouldn't be too much to report. It's not going to make any difference, really. Not much difference. We weren't expecting it to make much difference. Obviously, there could be changes. So if the Ogden rate changes, we'll get a benefit in runoff as well as a benefit in motor and commercial. Then we'd probably report that separately.
If there's anything significant, yeah, we'll report it. But
the expectation is not going to be dramatic.
Yeah.
That's why we. On the home loss ratio side, and the way maybe think about this is if you take the 2017 core, which was just under 90, and you probably need to add, for weather, which is the main normalizing point, you probably need to add 4 to 5 points to that. So it comes to about a normalized core of 94, 95. You've got to think about the partners that they will take a bit of a difference in the commission ratio when that happens. But you end up about 94 to 95. And then looking forward, you've got a few moving parts on home. So you've got nationwide premium reduction, NEP reduction, over 1 year, so there won't be any in 19, and there'll be half a year basically in 18, and that's a reasonably large part of our NEP. On the other hand, they do take quite a lot of commission, so the commission ratio is going to come down, I expect, quite significantly in home in 2018. And on the accident loss year, or on the attritional loss ratio side, they have low attritional loss ratios relative to the rest of our business. So there's a little bit of strain because of that. But I think overall, you're probably going to see, we think there will be an improvement in core in home, normalized, because of that commission ratio reduction, which is quite significant. And that will broadly balance the reduction in premiums. There's a few moving parts, but that should give you some more guidance, if that helps. Do you remember systems?
Yeah, I mean, basically, we've given a few clues to quite a lot of moving opportunities that we have in IT costs. So across the basket of all those, we see opportunities. The mainframe kind of usage comes down, and then you get a big saving at the end. But there are other moving parts that Steve has got in plan to reduce. I think we've given some flavour of them in terms of procurement and. Steve, do you want to give a flavour?
I think Paul's right. Paul's right. I mean, there's a number of initiatives that, and levers that we're pulling here. I mean, Paul's reference, first thing we do is we go and strike better deals. That gets an immediate benefit for us. As we, in effect, implement these new systems and we are, in effect, replatforming most of the front-end systems in the business, you'll get a gradual reduction in your mainframe usage over time as you migrate to these new systems. That's an ongoing feature. You then get to sort of final decommissioning. That gives us another kick in terms of benefit. And of course, in parallel to that, any system that you're not addressing by replatforming, we're re-engineering to make the underlying MIP usage, reduce it, eliminate it, or get a better deal on it. So there's about four levers that we're pulling, and each of those, has an impact over the life of our plan.
Yes, right. Well, let's move to Andrew Field.
Thanks. It's Andrew Green of Autonomous. Three questions, if I can. Firstly, on motor PCW, I think your market share has been broadly flat, and I think with this new pricing machine, you're anticipating building market share there. Can you share with us some of your ambitions, say, for this year in terms of policy count growth from the pricing? Secondly, CapEx. Are you still guiding to 80 to 100 for this year? And I think you said there's a bit of a bubble. Will that drop down from 19 onwards? And then finally, on Whiplash and Ogden, can you say a little bit about what you anticipate the legislative position is on that? And if you don't get anything through Parliament on Ogden, what happens?
I'll start with the last one. The government's announced a timetable to introduce legislation to get the kind of two parts of Whiplash in by next April. There's quite a lot of work to be done by all parties to get that to happen. There's quite a lot of systems work to be done. So, and of course, they need to get it passed. So, but you know, our planning assumption is that that will happen for next April. But there's some risks to that, I think, in terms of, you know, legislation and then all the systems work needs to be done to enact it, because there's quite a lot of technical changes to make that work. And Steve can obviously say bore you at the break, but he can tell you the break with his MIB hat on about all the work needs to be done to make that happen. Now, whether Ogden hitches long for the ride of the civil liabilities bill or not is a debate, and there are pros and cons to whether it does hitch long for the ride. There's obviously dangers of attaching, but it's up to the government to get that done. You know, they've set out quite a clear intention to get it done, and it's up to them. We're unclear on the legislative vehicle they're going to use to do it. Now, obviously, what happens, it depends on what, if it doesn't happen, it depends on why it doesn't happen and whether it's just a timing thing. Because, of course, really what matters is that it does eventually happen, because we're talking about claims that will be settling in a few years' time. So it's not month critical to that extent. But clearly, if it fails for a specific reason, if the government goes back on its commitment, that would be very different to this gets retimed. And, of course, really what matters is the reinsurance, materially it's the reinsurance costs. So we've got, you know, the next real thing is next year's renegotiation of the reinsurance contracts. So we've got, you know, pretty good protection this year, and of course that reinsurance contract was struck with some expectations of the rate changing, not full. Does that give you enough? Do you want to do? I mean, PCWs. Listen, a lot of the initiatives we talked about are not this year. Will be so the alternative pricing will be. We're aiming to get some experience this year, but I think this is a medium life of the plan ambition that we're setting out here on PCWs. There's a lot to it. But I think you should take it as quite a big stake in the ground today that we're saying there's no reason we see we shouldn't be leading edge at PCWs, and we know what the deltas are, and we think that we have the systems work and the initiatives to close that application fraud, pricing we've talked about. And as I say, you know, alternative pricing approach.
CapEx, I think, we haven't given guidance, but beyond 2019, clearly, we're still going to be investing as a business beyond there. I think we are in a bubble at the moment, so we're, you know, we've been at the upper end of that range. We'll probably stay at the upper end of that range in the short term. But I don't think it means that we stop investing in the business in 2019. Maybe you'll back a bit. But.
Front row.
Hi, it's Cameron Hussain from RBC. Just one big picture question. So you talked a lot about kind of the changed distribution model, how you're able to access all the three main channels. When you think about partnerships, one of the big four price comparison websites last week set out its ambitions to partner with banking apps. So, you know, straight in via API into their apps, they can offer all sorts of services. Do you see any, I mean, when you think about that change to the market or that potential change to the market, is it a threat? Is it an opportunity? Does it change the way that affinity might work going forward? Because obviously a lot of big affinity deals, especially on the home side, are with banks. So any thoughts on the big picture question?
Yeah, I mean, generally we've seen this leg of our kind of strategic pyramid as giving us some strategic optionality. And I think, you know, one of the things we want to do is, if we're not a great retailer, we'd certainly like to be the smart and efficient manufacturer behind other great retailers. You know, we are. I think that gives us some strategic optionality. You know, if our retail brands don't win in the marketplace, which we hope they will, working with other people's, we think all those people will need people like us to have our excellence at all the things which we're really great at. So, and I think that's revealed on our approach on motor, which you know other people could view as a hostile trend. We're running straight towards it and saying, okay, you know, you motor manufacturers have a lot of assets, increasing a bunch of assets in terms of how people will purchase or not cars, and the data will get out of them. We want to partner with you, and if you know. So I think there's risks and opportunities. I think the way of mitigating the risks is being part of, being open-minded to partner with people that have different distribution models. Then I think banks clearly have a variety of partnership models in mind. I think there are some real benefits of how you partner with them. We've really turned around our business with NatWest RBS. By really closely linking our systems and theirs to make it really, really easy for their customers to get a great price from us, and that's really working well. So, you know, I think that model has some advantages versus putting it into a PCW, but I would say that. And of course, in PCWs, less than we write about 40% of our business on PCWs and home. So you know, we're in that channel too. So I think it's great to be across all the channels. I think net of all of that, because I don't think any of us can necessarily say the way the future is exactly going. Yes.
Hi, Drew Pilot, HSBC. Two questions. Firstly, on the runoff book, could you quantify what is the reserve which is still tied there and the capital in that book? Secondly, just going back to the RBS renewal on your partnership, would we expect to see any change there, as in terms of numbers, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, it's a slightly historic reference to the renewal. It's a couple of years back, and so I'm sure we'll be on to the next one at some stage, but that's the nature of partnership. That's quite mature on home. The rescue is a more recent deal, and that's reflected in our kind of in our numbers. But there's no big change. Mike?
For travel is in.
Yeah, sorry, we're in pitch on travel with them. And as we say, these things like travel and rescue, it's really a volume. You know, we like to have the volume because it means you can have more people that know more languages, but it's pretty fine margin stuff. So we kind of do take it or leave it a little bit. But travel's the one with RBS currently in pitch, having got home and rescue.
I think we're just...
It's deciding who'd answer.
I think the reserves are actually in the prelim. It's about $265 million in the runoff book. We haven't published a capital number. You'd expect it to use higher capital than other parts because of the PPO nature of it. But we haven't actually given a number. This is maybe how I guess.
Good. Last one. Bring us home.
Thomas. Let's see. So price comparison, you talked about the capability part of the game. Isn't it mainly a cost game? And so my question is, how often do you come out top on the business you quote on price comparison, home and motor? Second question on partnerships, same thing. I mean, it's capabilities, but aren't the partners basically, you know, just giving the business to the lowest price, so the best price, and hence it's a winner's curse if you win a partnership? And thirdly, on the price increases you and the market has done, has that led to increased switching rates in home and motor?
Very good. So to deal with the last one first, so retention's up a bit in motor, down a little bit in home, but I mean all like plus or minus 1% on both, but still direct line, you know, cracking levels, mid-80s in retention. And people are shopping around. People are shopping around, I think, a bit more on home driven by the prior year disclosure premium. And again, that's encouraging. You know, we think that's the right thing to do. And, you know, we've kept excellent retention rates, but down just a little bit on home, just up a little bit on motor. Partnerships, we use the word selective because you're right. Partnerships fall into two buckets. Commodity partnerships, which generally go to the wire and there probably is winner's curse on it. And then there's probably strategic partnerships where people come to us, and people do come to us and go, we love what you're doing in Direct Line. We love your digital front ends. We love your API links. We love your accident repair centers. We love your propositions. We love your, you know, award-winning customer experience stuff. So they come to us, and then they're looking. People with brands tend to want to work with somebody that understands about brands and giving brand differentiation and great brand experience. So those are the sorts of partnerships we want to win. We're happy to win some more commodity ones, specifically where it gives us scale like travel and rescue, and then we're happy to walk away from quite a lot of them as well. So the word selective is quite important there. I think on PCWs, to keep a stable, quite big share of it, we're pretty competitive. We win a lot every week, so we are pretty competitive. We quite accurately can benchmark, you know, there's a couple of peers that this is what they do all the time, PCWs, and we can quite specifically say, okay, here's what they do, here's what we do, here's how they get a bit more competitive and still do it at good loss ratios, and we know what those deltas are, and we think we have the plans and the capabilities over the next couple of years to close some of that. Lots about application fraud. Some of it is having price models specifically geared to that PCW customer rather than a direct customer, because we tend to have, as I said, one pricing model. So we have it in our sights. There's nothing I see in our way. I think on pricing as well, you've got to look at you know, the marginal cost is what really matters here. The cost of an extra policy, which is increasingly will be direct and self-service. So actually, we shouldn't be held back on a marginal cost basis, and we should, again, benefit from the group's brands, because, you know, we have fantastic brands, and brands still matter in PCWs, particularly in terms of better retention rates.
And we benefit from the group's, you know, fantastic claims, fantastic accident repair centres. So we have a lot of assets. And actually, you know, getting from where we are now to where we want to be, you know, these are all quite, you know, this is a small wins thing. Actually, we're pretty good to be winning so much business today to keep that business stable.
And application fraud, is it a major improvement you are going for?
Yeah, I mean, we catch more fraud than anyone else at claims. And that's a great place to catch it, better not catching it. We'd even more rather not get any of it on the books. And so we know the few things we want to do. So we're pushing forward progressively on that. We're not bad at it. Without that, we wouldn't be able to write any business. But, you know, we have some good initiatives there. Right. Thank you very much. We should just send anyone on the phones.
Okay, thank you very much to the panelists. So, ladies and gentlemen, over the phone, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Please ensure your line is unmuted locally, and then you'll be advised when to ask your question. So it's star 1 now. Thank you. Just bear with me a few more seconds. So at the moment, no questions coming through, so I'll hand back over to you.
Thank you very much. Before everyone goes here, can we switch off the lines? But nothing huge or dramatic is going to happen. We just have one final slide, which is just to say goodbye to John. Some pictures of John. The great benefit of John and I is we don't actually get any older through the whole journey, because I've always looked 48, and John just always looks not his age. So John,
me prepping for my interview.
John's been sharing with us his diary just for next week, and we're all deeply into it. So John has a fantastic selection of non-work things to do. On John's behalf, to be a fantastic board member, because I think he's been an absolutely terrific CFO, fantastic colleague, fantastic friend, and if you think about where we've come from, your questions reveal not everything's still lots to do in the business, and Penny's still got lots of opportunities. But I think John's done a cracking job here. He's been a fantastic colleague, he's been a fantastic friend, he's been a fantastic CFO, and I'd just like to wish him all success in the future. If you'd join me.